It's time once again for the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Welcome. On today's program, you'll hear a piece from Muscular Dystrophy News Today, describing some of the achievements of the disability rights movement. From the Child Mind Institute, an article entitled, When Problem Behavior Masks a Learning Disability. You'll hear a piece about Medicaid expansion and disability services from the ARC. And we'll begin with an article from the April issue of the Braille Monitor entitled The Power of Audio Description by Corey Grandstaff from the editor. Corey Grandstaff is the treasurer of our Washington affiliate and works as an associate director of transition and residential programs at the Washington State School for the Blind. He also has his own business providing independent living skills training to older blind adults. He lives in Vancouver, Washington, with his wife, Arabia. Corey's work, business, and federation duties might not seem to leave a lot of spare time, but apparently he finds some time to enjoy TV and movies. He says the following about how his appreciation of audio description, which is the narration of visual elements of TV programs and movies for the blind and low vision viewers, has evolved since his childhood. I remember one of the first times I experienced audio description, AD, as a child. I hated it. I'm not sure if it had to do with the quality of the AD or if it was that, for the first time, I got to know each detail of the particular movie. It was the film Old Yeller, and it was one of the Descriptive Video Service, DVS, tapes that you could order by mail at the time. I remember crying every time I watched the movie and wishing the AD had not filled me in during each scene because of how sad the movie was. I also remember theaters offering AD when I went to the movies with my friends in high school or college, and feeling that I was not normal when I wore the headphones to hear it. Fast forward to now, when I am in my mid-30s and I rarely watch a movie or television show that is not audio described. I even find myself going back to television shows or movies that were favorites of mine as a kid, because as I watch them with AD now, I realize how much I miss them. As a child, I was completely comfortable listening to films or TV shows and applying my own interpretation to what I heard. As an adult, I finally feel fully engaged with these movies and shows because of the enhancement that AD brings to experiencing them. Take just one example. Among my favorite movies as a teen were the films of the Godfather trilogy. In the fall of 2024, I went back and watched all three movies with audio description. I have a much deeper appreciation for the trilogy and love the movies even more than I used to as a teen. In addition, for the first time, I knew what the characters were saying when they spoke in Italian, as the audio description also included reading of the English subtitles. Another example of the power of audio description is the time that I viewed the Rose Parade with live, real-time audio description. I remember sitting down with my family as a child to watch this annual New Year's Day event live and having a basic idea of what each float was, but no clue as to the details of its appearance or how intricate those details or designs were. Watching the Rose Parade for the first time with audio description gave me a much deeper appreciation for the talent and creativity that went into each float. I never realized how providing audio description of a live event could be life-changing. This leaves me asking, why did it take me so long to embrace the power of audio description? Is it that when I was a child, you had to go to certain theaters or buy special DVS tapes to access it? Whereas now, most movie theaters are required to have AD equipment, and I can tune my TV to popular streaming services such as Max, Hulu, Disney Plus, Paramount Plus, and Netflix, and they have AD for much of their programming? Or is it that as an adult, I do not feel the stigma that I did as a child because I do not care if others see me as different or weird because I wear headphones at the movie theater? Or is it because the quality of audio description has improved since I was younger? For me, it is a bit of all three. Having the ability to turn on my TV to the streaming services I use to access AD, not caring how people look at me, and knowing the quality of AD has improved over the years. I will say it is disappointing when popular channels such as Starz have no programming that is audio described. When I notice AD is not available, it leaves me uninterested in watching the series or movie or in paying for the service. So, what are my hopes for the future of audio description? The streaming services I listed above have made great advances in what AD they provide, but it is still frustrating when you go to watch a show and it is not audio described. An even more frustrating experience is when seasons 3 through 6 are audio described, but seasons 1 and 2 are not. And then, as I mentioned, there are some networks that offer no audio description. So, my hope for the future is that every show can offer AD, that more live events offer live AD, and that the quality and consistency of audio description continues to improve. The work that we must do in advocating for audio description is far from over. However, at least from my perspective, the value that audio description adds is just one example of how providing access can change the lives of blind people and help us to live the lives we want every day. Now here's a piece from Muscular Dystrophy News Today entitled, "Wake Up to the Achievements of the Disability Rights Movement. Spread Awareness of Our Champions and Maybe Become One Yourself," by Patrick Meeshan, published April 7, 2025. This August will mark 40 years since I was diagnosed with what we eventually discovered was limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. Though it's taken me many years to accept my condition, it's progressed slowly over the past four decades, and in that way, it's somewhat akin to the movement in the United States that's focused on rights for the disabled. Shifts in attitudes toward our marginalized population over the past several decades have developed slowly, but they've brought about positive changes in how we disabled folks live our lives. I'd like to share some of the names that all of us living with chronic conditions should know about. Names I've discovered by reading about the history of the disability rights movement, or, as I like to refer to it, the disability revolution. A National Parks Service article helped me learn key milestones and dates associated with progress for the disabled community in the U.S., where I live. Of chief importance here are the people who made it possible for those of us living with disabilities today to enjoy accessible public buildings, curb cuts, lifts on public transportation, and barrier-free access to public education, among other improvements. It's important to be aware of the giants whose shoulders we now sit on. Some of our champions. We have Centers for Independent Living in every state in the country, thanks largely to Ed Roberts and John Hessler. Did you know about them? Neither did I, but I do now. Roberts, a polio survivor, was the first student in a wheelchair to attend the University of California, Berkeley, among other achievements. Hessler, also in a wheelchair, was his contemporary there. We have accessibility to public buildings thanks in part to Jennifer Keelan Chaffins and others who literally crawled up 83 concrete steps on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., to illustrate barriers facing the disabled community. Children's books have recorded how she crawled up the steps when she was 8 years old. Did you know about her? Neither did I, but I do now. She's still active in our community and still fighting to break barriers. We have access to educational services in public schools because of the work of many people, including Judy Heumann. I urge everyone, not just the disability community, to read her memoir, Being Human. You'll learn how groups of physically and mentally disabled people shined a light on disability access in the 1970s by sitting on streets in front of buses and peacefully occupying government buildings. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, our single biggest piece of legislation today because of activists like Justin and Yoshiko Dart. When President George H.W. Bush signed the bill into law in 1980, Justin Dart was seated beside him. Did you know about him? Every American should. It's paramount that we continue the work that these people and so many others have undertaken. The disabled community has come a long way, but there's always more ground to gain. While researching this piece, I came across words from former Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, who helped draft the ADA, calling it an Emancipation Proclamation for people with disabilities. He also said that disabled individuals spend a lifetime overcoming not what God wrought, but what man has imposed by custom and law. Take a moment to read that last sentence again. People living with disabilities often don't see our biggest challenge as biology, though it's a large part of our conditions. Instead, we experience society as our biggest obstacle. That truth drives the incredible history of a movement that's akin to that of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the battle for civil rights. But sadly, little about the disability rights movement is taught in schools. Perhaps that should be added to the list of things we need to change. I challenge everyone reading these words to do some research and share what you learn about the history of the disabled revolution. Moreover, let us all add another chapter, or 10, to the movement. The story won't end until disabled people are no longer marginalized in and by society at large. We must all continue to learn, share, and teach. The progression of a chronic disease isn't fun, but the progression of society is something we can and should all share. Our next piece comes from India Today. How Joseph Pulitzer Turned His Blindness into a Vision for Modern Journalism. The Pulitzer Prizes, founded in 1917 by newspaper giant Joseph Pulitzer, are America's highest honors in journalism, letters, and arts, recognitions of excellence in truth, storytelling, and artistry. From immigrant to icon, Pulitzer shaped the press. Written by Rishad Chauhan, published April 10, 2025. When we discuss excellence in journalism, literature, or the arts, the Pulitzer Prize is the first to spring to mind. But behind this symbol of excellence stands the extraordinary story of Joseph Pulitzer, a Hungarian immigrant and a broken soldier who went on to become the head of Pulitzer Publishing. Before the Pulitzer Prize became the yardstick of American letters and journalism, there lived an irritable boy with dismal prospects in the small Hungarian town of Mach, born on April 10, 1847. Joseph Pulitzer was not destined for power or privilege. In fact, he was disqualified for military service in Europe due to bad eyesight, frail health, and even an excitable temperament. Just 17 years old, Pulitzer crossed the Atlantic and touched the shores of the U.S. in the city of Boston, with no funds and no command of English, speaking only French and German. The U.S. Civil War was raging at that time, so he joined the Union Army and fought in a German-speaking cavalry regiment. This was his introduction to American life. After the war, Pulitzer was earning a living by doing odd work and reading books in the public library in St. Louis. Chance brought him in contact with one of the German language newspapers there, and it offered him work as a reporter. His intelligence was sharp and his writing ruthless. He owned his first paper at the age of 25. That essay would later evolve into the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, a newspaper he vowed would oppose all frauds and shams, no matter how powerful. Pulitzer possessed a flair for reporting. He would work 16 hours a day, from 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. He was referred to as Joey the German or Joey the Jew. The journey continued to reshape the world of journalism. Launching New York World and years later. In 1883, Pulitzer bought the struggling New York World, an English newspaper which had been popular in the U.S. He turned it into a sensation, filling it with ferocious headlines, muckraking exposés, and sketches that captured the imagination of millions. Under Pulitzer's leadership, circulation rose from 15,000 to 600,000, and the New York World became the nation's biggest newspaper. He felt that journalism should inform and serve the people. He took on crooked politicians, unmasked business trusts, and brought the newspaper out as a crusader for justice. His newspapers voiced the interests of the immigrants, the toilers, and the downtrodden. Ironically, in building an information empire, his own universe was darkening. Pulitzer was nearly blind by his 40s. His health was failing, and he lived in virtual solitude on a yacht outfitted as a floating newsroom. But he was still involved in all the nitty-gritty, reading proofs in Braille, dictating editorials, and expanding the boundaries of journalism with unlimited vigor. Behind the public bluster of Pulitzer was a deeply introspective individual, troubled by the power of the press. As he grew older, he turned inward, fretting about his legacy. In his will, Pulitzer left Columbia University $2 million to found a school of journalism and to create an annual series of prizes for journalistic excellence. The launch of the Pulitzer Prizes. The first Pulitzer Prizes were awarded in 1917, 6 years after he had passed away. Four for journalism, four for letters and drama, one for education, and four traveling scholarships. The tone of the prize was clear: to honor those who spoke truth, who enlightened the world, and who, like Pulitzer himself, saw much more than the majority, even in the dark. Over the decades, the prize has become the most coveted recognition for writers, reporters, photographers, playwrights, and composers. It prizes courage, clarity, and craftsmanship, but at its core remains the unconquerable spirit of a blind immigrant kid who believed that the truth was not just to be told, but to be fought for. And now an article from Child Mind Institute entitled, "When Problem Behavior Masks a Learning Disability: How to Tell if a Child Who's Acting Out Actually Needs Help in School." Written by Shelley Flannery. Clinical experts Angela Dewey, Ph.D., Rachel Gans, Ph.D. Every parent has experienced or seen a child melting down at school drop-off. But for the family of one seven-year-old, tantrums at the entrance were a daily occurrence. The girl was so distraught about going to school that she would cry and cling to her mother until the principal came out and physically helped her through the front door. What was initially assumed to be anxiety or a behavior disorder turned out to be a learning disability. When we assessed her, we found that she had dyslexia, said neuropsychologist Angela Dewey, Ph.D. She wasn't being defiant. She was overwhelmed by reading and writing tasks. Children who struggle in school sometimes act out, resisting homework, refusing to participate, even becoming disruptive in class. To parents and teachers, it may come across as defiance or disinterest, but in many cases, These behaviors are signs of an undiagnosed learning disability that can make school more challenging. A lot of times, parents come in saying their child is out of control, says Dr. Dewey, who evaluates kids at the Child Mind Institute's Gund Learning and Diagnostic Center. What we sometimes find is that there's an underlying learning issue that's driving the behavior. Understanding the connection between behavior and learning disorders can help parents and educators provide the right support and prevent children from falling behind academically and socially. What is a learning disorder? Learning disorders are rooted in how a child's brain processes information. These neurological differences can make reading, writing, math, or paying attention much harder than for other kids. These difficulties are not due to a lack of intelligence or effort. Rather, they stem from differences in brain function that makes learning tasks more challenging. Parents and teachers sometimes assume that a struggling child just isn't trying hard enough. But as Dr. Dewey explains, kids do well when they can. If a child is acting out or refusing to do schoolwork, it's usually not because they don't want to learn. It's because something is getting in their way. How learning disorders can look like behavior problems. When kids can't explain their struggles, their frustration often shows up in their behavior or even physical symptoms. A child may become easily frustrated with homework, seem disorganized, or refuse to follow directions. Anticipating a difficult school day can make kids anxious, leading to meltdowns, avoidance, or physical symptoms such as stomach aches. A lot of times, we see children who have learning disorders come in with symptoms that are very consistent with anxiety, Dr. Dewey says. For example, some kids with undiagnosed learning disorders have significant school avoidance, shutting down or even refusing to go inside the building. Others may have meltdowns before school, but manage to regulate their emotions once inside the classroom. If a child consistently struggles in a particular subject and reacts strongly to school-related stress, it could be a sign of an underlying learning disorder. Dyslexia, when reading leads to frustration. Dyslexia, a reading disorder, is one of the most common types of learning disabilities and often presents as behavioral issues. A child who struggles to read may avoid reading assignments, refuse to read aloud, or become frustrated when asked to complete literacy-based tasks. Children with dyslexia may also develop strategies to hide their difficulties. Some kids become the class clown to distract from their reading struggles, said Rachel Gans, Ph.D., a neuropsychologist in the Gund Learning and Diagnostic Center at the Child Mind Institute. Others may act like they don't care or claim that reading is boring when, in reality, they're struggling. Math and writing disorders, avoidance and anxiety. Among the different types of learning disabilities, dyscalculia specifically impacts a child's ability to work with numbers, while dysgraphia affects their ability to write. Children with these disorders might procrastinate, forget assignments, or get upset when asked to do work specific to these areas. Students with dysgraphia may struggle with handwriting, spelling, and organizing their thoughts on paper. For some kids, writing a single sentence is exhausting and frustrating, Dr. Gans explains. That frustration can lead to avoidance, and teachers might assume the child is just unmotivated. Dr. Gans points out that school avoidance is often linked to learning difficulties. Kids with undiagnosed learning disorders may feel sick before school, ask to go to the nurse, or frequently request bathroom breaks during class, especially before a difficult subject like reading or math. ADHD, impulsivity mistaken for defiance. Although not technically a learning disorder, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, also makes learning much more difficult. It is a neurodevelopmental disorder that affects a child's ability to focus, regulate impulses, and manage tasks. Kids with ADHD may have trouble following directions, staying on task, or sitting still, behaviors that can be mistaken for defiance. Parents will say their child can focus for hours on video games, but not on homework, so they must just be lazy, Dr. Dewey says. But that's not the case. Kids with ADHD struggle to regulate their attention, which means focusing on non-preferred tasks is much harder for them. Additionally, ADHD can affect emotional regulation. Kids with ADHD often have a low frustration tolerance, Dr. Gans said. They might go from 0 to 100 in an instant, throwing a tantrum over a simple homework assignment because they feel overwhelmed. How learning disorders affect emotional well-being. It's not only academics that suffer when a child has a learning disorder. They often affect a child's social and emotional well-being, too. When kids struggle with academics, it often affects their confidence and self-esteem, Dr. Dewey says. They may feel embarrassed in front of their peers or worry about being called on in class. That anxiety can sometimes show up as avoidance, aggression, or complete shutdown. In some cases, children may develop anxiety or depression as a result of their struggles. We see kids who internalize their academic difficulties, blaming themselves for not being smart enough, Dr. Gans said. This can lead to feelings of worthlessness or even school refusal. Additionally, children with undiagnosed learning disorders may struggle with social interactions. They might have trouble keeping up with conversations, following rules in games, or remembering instructions. This can make it difficult to form friendships, leading to feelings of isolation. Steps to take if you suspect a learning disorder. Recognizing the signs of different types of learning disabilities is the first step, but figuring out what to do next can feel overwhelming. Fortunately, there are clear steps parents and teachers can take to better understand a child's struggles and put the right support in place. Observe patterns. If your child's behavior is raising red flags, the first step is to look for patterns. Are they struggling in a particular subject? Do they act out at certain times of the day? Identifying when and where the challenges occur can help uncover an underlying learning disorder. Teachers and parents should track when behavioral issues occur. If a child only acts out during reading or math, that's a red flag that an underlying issue may be at play, says Dr. Gans. Patterns give us important clues. Seek a professional evaluation. Many schools have the ability to evaluate students for learning disorders. Private neuropsychological testing is also an option in the event testing isn't available at your child's school. You disagree with the school's findings? Or you wish to gain more personalized insight into your child's specific disability. Early intervention can prevent years of frustration, Dr. Dewey says. Without a diagnosis, kids may internalize their struggles and believe they're just not smart enough, which isn't true. Explore intervention strategies. Once a learning disorder is identified, the right support can make all the difference. With targeted interventions, children can develop the skills they need to succeed academically and feel more confident in their abilities. For dyslexia, multisensory reading programs such as Orton-Gillingham or Wilson Reading Systems can help children strengthen their literacy skills. Parents and teachers can also encourage the use of audiobooks, provide extra time on assignments, and use phonics-based instruction to build reading confidence. For math and writing disorders, structured step-by-step teaching methods, graphic organizers, and hands-on learning strategies can make complex math concepts easier to grasp. speech-to-text tools and extra time on assignments can also support children who struggle with writing. For ADHD, executive function coaching, structured routines, and behavioral therapy can help children manage focus, organization, and self-regulation, making school tasks more manageable. Medication can improve students' ability to focus. Schools can also provide accommodations such as extra time on tests or modified assignments to support children with learning disorders. Why early intervention matters. Early diagnosis and intervention can help children build confidence and avoid unnecessary frustration. The earlier we identify a learning disorder, the sooner we can put supports in place, Dr. Gans says. Getting a diagnosis isn't about labeling kids, it's about giving them the right tools to succeed. Now, a reminder that you're listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Our program continues with a piece from Newsweek entitled, "Woman Who's Blind Goes Viral Saying She Can Hear Where Tree Is. Here's How." Published April 12, 2025 by Melissa Fleur Afshar. Molly Burke has spent over a decade bridging the gap between the blind and sighted communities through lighthearted lifestyle videos. But it was a spontaneous moment in a California park that has newly piqued the interest of viewers online. In her video, shared to her TikTok account, @MollyBurkeOfficial, on March 25th, Burke, 31, demonstrates what she calls the echo technique, a form of passive echolocation she uses to detect objects in her environment by sound. "I was just walking through this park, no guide dog, no cane, no nothing, and I reached my hand out and touched this tree because I could hear it," Burke told viewers online while standing beside a tree in the footage. "My boyfriend was like, 'What are you doing?' And I was like, 'This tree was so loud, it freaked me out.'" The post has received almost 500,000 views and over 50,000 likes, with TikTok users expressing amazement at how Burke navigates the world around her using only her hearing. Burke, a Canadian-born content creator based in Los Angeles, California, lost most of her sight at 14 years old due to retinitis pigmentosa, a rare degenerative disease. Burke began her career as a motivational speaker before moving into digital storytelling on YouTube and Instagram when she turned 20. "I've been a social media content creator for over 10 years now," Burke told Newsweek. "I create lifestyle content from the perspective of a blind woman, which includes anything from beauty and fashion to fitness and travel, plus a whole lot of cute dog," Burke added. Her guide dog, named Elton John, features prominently in her posts and helps her navigate more complex environments. But it was her less visible navigational tool, the echo technique, that recently sparked renewed interest from her followers. "Echolocation is a technique used by some blind people to help us navigate," Burke said. "I was trained in passive echolocation by my orientation and mobility instructor as a child. Unlike active echolocation, which involves producing clicks or snaps to generate sound waves, passive echolocation relies on natural sound waves in the environment. These sound waves bounce off surfaces, creating what Burke refers to as sound shadows." Burke said that her instructor got her acquainted with the technique by blindfolding her, even when she could still see, and asking her to count trees while walking down a sidewalk. While the technique does not replace traditional aids such as canes or guide dogs, it serves as a complementary tool. "It helps me figure out how large a space is, if there are obstacles, where new hallways or door openings are, Burke said. It is not a skill all blind people have, use, or are trained in. This is a skill that needs to be learned and is not some sort of superpower you naturally tap into when you lose your vision. Burke's recent bout of viral success was unplanned, as she had just been taking her guide dog to the park for some off-harness playtime when she reacted to the presence of a small tree. Her boyfriend noticed her ability to move safely past it without help and began filming their conversation. I've talked about my use of passive echolocation in the past, but have not brought it up for a long time, Burke said. This video was a reminder of this for old viewers and also reached a lot of newer viewers who have never heard me discuss this topic before. The reaction online has ranged from curious to incredulous, with many viewers debating what Burke meant when she described the tree as loud. I was referring to the sound shadow being a loud, strong one, meaning the sound waves coming off it felt very intense, despite it being a thin tree, she said. Burke added she hopes that sharing her experience will deepen public understanding of how blind individuals experience the world. It goes to show that the human experience is unique and diverse, she said. While we are all living in the same world, we are experiencing it in different ways, which should be celebrated and respected. Sharing her story online. Burke's journey to becoming a digital advocate began with her own need for connection. As a teenager, losing her vision isolated her from peers and sent her into depression. I felt so alone and misunderstood, Burke said. It felt like everyone was treating me differently after my vision loss, even though I felt like I was still the same person. YouTube became a lifeline, and watching beauty and fashion content provided a much-needed sense of belonging and normalcy. These girls became my community, Burke said. They felt like they were my friends, even though they did not know me. Years later, Burke decided to share her own story online. At the time, I had just quit my dream job as a full-time touring motivational speaker and moved back into my childhood home. I reflected back on how powerful YouTube had been for me and decided it was time to start sharing my own story. More than a decade later, Burke has built a multi-platform presence under @MollyBurkeOfficial that combines accessibility education with humor, fashion, and daily life, and she is now introducing more people to the little-known echo technique. While almost everyone has the ability to do this, including sighted people, many are not aware of it because they are so distracted by seeing the world around them or because they have not been given the tools to help enhance it, Burke said. While I am far from the best at it, it is a skill I'm very grateful to have been taught from a young age. Up next, from The Arc, an article entitled The Truth About Medicaid Expansion and Disability Services, published April 11, 2025, by The Arc. In recent debates over Medicaid's future, some have suggested that extending coverage to low-income adults through Medicaid expansion has diverted resources away from people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, IDD, and undermined the program's original purpose. That claim is both misleading and dangerous. It risks turning vulnerable communities against one another and distracting from the real threats facing Medicaid that come from significant cuts. Medicaid expansion and HCBS waiting lists are not connected. The argument that Medicaid expansion led to longer waiting lists for people with disabilities who need home and community-based services, HCBS, is often repeated but easily disproven. There is no correlation between whether a state expanded Medicaid and whether its HCBS waiting list grew. 10 of the 11 states without HCBS waiting lists are expansion states, and the two states with the largest waiting lists, Texas and Florida, are non-expansion states. In fact, Texas's waiting list alone represents nearly half of the nation's total. Because HCBS programs are optional services within Medicaid, states control their own waiver programs, including how many people are served and how much funding is allocated. Thanks to growing support for HCBS, Medicaid has made significant progress in shifting long-term care away from institutions and into the community. In 2022, 65% of long-term services and supports, LTSS, spending went to HCBS, compared to only 18% in 1995. Blaming Medicaid expansion for state-level decisions about HCBS funding misrepresents how the program works and distracts from the need for stronger investments in these essential services. Cutting Medicaid funding won't help people with disabilities. Reducing or eliminating federal funding for the Medicaid expansion population would not free up money for people with IDD. It just means less funding overall for the entire program. Medicaid is a vital part of our social safety net, which ensures that everyone who needs care can get it, whether they're managing a chronic condition, caring for a child with disabilities, or working a low-wage job without access to employer-provided coverage. We should be fighting to expand services and reduce waiting lists, not blaming other groups of enrollees for long-standing systemic challenges. A Medicaid program that works for everyone is the goal. The truth is, Medicaid expansion has strengthened the program overall by bringing in new resources to support people and expanding access to care for millions of people, including many with IDD and care workers. Many people with serious health conditions and disabilities do not meet the strict disability eligibility standards necessary to access Medicaid through the Supplemental Security Income Program, SSI, or do not want to impoverish themselves to meet the SSI income and asset limits. Medicaid expansion has helped many people with disabilities access critically needed health care. What endangers HCBS and other critical supports for people with disabilities are proposals to slash federal support for Medicaid under the pretext of targeting waste, fraud, and abuse within the program. We should be investing in HCBS, increasing pay for caregivers, and expanding access to LTSS, not rolling back coverage or undermining Medicaid's foundation. And now from the Disability Scoop, RFK Jr. promises to uncover cause of autism epidemic by September. This article is by Michelle Diament, published April 11, 2025. The nation's top health official is promising to determine by this fall why autism rates have surged in recent decades. In a cabinet meeting Thursday, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services said that his agency is working to find out what's behind the rapid rise in prevalence of the developmental disability, and he committed to an ambitious deadline to reach a conclusion. We have launched a massive testing and research effort that's going to involve hundreds of scientists from around the world, Kennedy told President Donald Trump and other top federal officials. By September, we will know what has caused the autism epidemic and will be able to eliminate those exposures. Autism rates have risen from 1 in 150 U.S. kids in the year 2000 to 1 in 36 currently, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Kennedy said in the cabinet meeting that he expects the rate to increase to 1 in 31. There will be no bigger news conference than that if you can come up with that answer, Trump said in response to Kennedy's pledge to pinpoint the cause. where you stop taking something, you stop eating something, or maybe it's a shot, but something's causing it. Experts attribute the jump in autism prevalence to better awareness, improved screening tools, and methods and changes in the diagnostic criteria. There are many causes of autism, according to Autism Speaks. Research suggests that autism spectrum disorder, ASD, develops from a combination of genetic influences and environmental influences, including social determinants. Kennedy, however, has spent years promoting a link between autism and vaccines, despite numerous studies discrediting that theory. During his confirmation hearing to lead HHS, he refused to disavow such views. More recently, under Kennedy's leadership, HHS said that the CDC is planning a large study examining the connection between autism and vaccines. The Washington Post reports that the agency has tapped vaccine skeptic David Geer to lead the study. Geer, who has been disciplined by the state of Maryland for practicing medicine without a license, and his father have published papers claiming an association between vaccines and autism, according to the newspaper. National autism advocacy groups, including Autism Speaks, the Autism Society of America, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and the Autism Science Foundation, have all asserted that vaccines do not cause autism. RFK Jr.'s comment is a clear signal that HHS intends to produce rigged and fraudulent research that supports Kennedy and Trump's pre-existing beliefs in a connection between autism and vaccines, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network said in a statement. It seems quite clear that he is forging ahead with rushing out misinformation to the public about the supposed causes of autism, said Colin Killick, the nonprofit's executive director, who called the timeline Kennedy is proposing far too fast for any genuine scientific research to be conducted. And here's another piece from the Disability Scoop, this one entitled, Trump's DEI Undoing Undermines Hard-Won Accommodations for People with Disabilities, by Stephanie Armour, KFF Health News, published April 10, 2025. For years, White House press conferences included sign language interpreters for the deaf. No longer. Interpreters have been noticeably absent from Trump administration press briefings, advocacy groups say. Gone, too, are the American Sign Language interpretations that used to appear on the White House YouTube channel, a White House webpage on accessibility, whitehouse.gov/accessibility, has also ceased working. From halting diversity programs that benefit people with disabilities to staffing cuts at the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Trump administration has taken a slew of actions that harm those with impairments or chronic health conditions. Decades of hard-fought gains risked being undone by cuts to federal programs, freezes on research funding, and a White House ban on practices that support diversity. Advocacy groups are pushing back, setting the stage for years of lawsuits and pitched health policy battles. Some leaders at organizations that serve people with disabilities are loath to publicly criticize White House actions because of concerns their groups could become targeted by the administration, especially if they rely on federal funding grants. The administration's March 27 restructuring announcement for HHS, which includes a significant downsizing of the workforce, would dismantle the Administration for Community Living and integrate its services into other parts of the agency. Within a week, when HHS staff cuts were announced, that federal office took a mortal hit. The Community Living Administration has focused on ensuring that seniors and people with disabilities can stay in their homes and communities as they age, and it has given $85 million to centers that help people live independently, among other investments. The funding, which came from stimulus legislation that Trump signed into law in 2020, enabled the centers to provide individuals with prepared meals, personal care items, and help with housing. This development has left the disability community reeling. What America needs now is a coordinated federal effort to make it easier for families to care for older adults and combat chronic disease, Sarita A. Mahanty, president and chief executive of the SCAN Foundation, a senior advocacy group, said in a statement. HHS's Administration for Community Living is the only dedicated government agency that helps older adults age in their home and in their community, which is what people say they want. Canceling the culture of DEI. From the get-go, Trump signed an executive order that directed the erasure of diversity, equity, and inclusion, which dealt a major setback to the disability rights movement. The ramifications have been sweeping. Several federal web pages that provided information on HIV vanished, and the administration cut grants related to HIV and AIDS. Staffers at HHS's U.S. Office of Infectious Disease and HIV/AIDS Policy also lost their jobs. The Social Security Administration ceased funding the Retirement and Disability Research Consortium, which conducted research addressing DEI in Social Security, retirement, and disability policies. Funding had supported such work as a study on transportation as a barrier to finding work for this population, and children with disabilities who receive Social Security transition to adulthood. The crackdown on DEI also halted or endangered disability-related research at the National Institutes of Health. That, on top of a proposed cap on related research costs that would slash $5.5 billion annually in NIH funding, has imperiled the work. A judge issued a nationwide preliminary injunction blocking the proposed cuts. Research at risk includes work on treatments for children with intellectual challenges and a study of muscular development that aims to help people with muscular dystrophy. SAGE, which aims to improve the lives of older LGBTQ+ people, is among the disability aid organizations that have had federal funding cut or halted or are worried their grants could be revoked. About a third of SAGE's funding comes from the federal government. Donna Sue Johnson, a licensed clinical social worker with post-traumatic stress disorder in New Rochelle, New York, says she relies on SAGE's socialization services. The 68-year-old said she's concerned by the DEI executive order and the discontinuation of grants, and she's also worried cuts to veterans services and to Medicaid will harm the disability community. This administration is very myopic, said Johnson, a former U.S. Army officer. My rights are being jeopardized as a veteran, a lesbian, and being disabled. They want to make you invisible. As another matter of concern, she pointed to Trump's signaled support for the House-passed GOP budget measure that would likely lead to billions of dollars in cuts from Medicaid, a federal state health program for people with disabilities and low incomes. Messaging from the top. These policy and programmatic decisions reflect a bias that starts with Trump, according to some disability rights groups. They say the president has a history of public derogatory comments about the people for whom they advocate. As evidence, they point to an episode in 2015 when Trump appeared to mock a New York Times reporter with a disability at a rally. Then-candidate Trump flailed his hands around in an apparent imitation of the reporter's physical movements. Trump later said he was not mocking the reporter. He is also reported to have said, "No one wants to see that," when referring to veterans with disabilities appearing at his events. More recently, Trump suggested a January mid-air collision between an American Airlines jet and an Army Black Hawk helicopter outside Washington, D.C., could be partially attributed to an alleged Biden-era focus on DEI hiring at the Federal Aviation Administration. There's no evidence a focus on diversity in hiring was related to the accident that killed all 67 people on both aircraft. The administration's creation of a commission to focus on issues such as the role of antidepressants and nutrition on autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and other chronic diseases also sends a troubling message, some advocates say. The memo establishing the Make America Healthy Again Commission sees people with disabilities and other chronic illnesses as a danger to the American way of life, said Maria Towne, president and chief executive of the American Association of People with Disabilities, describing what disability rights advocates consider to be the White House's prevailing view. Rollbacks to programs that help people with disabilities aren't occurring only as new policies. The administration is also taking direct action at specific agencies. Trump fired two of the three Democratic commissioners who serve on the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a five-member panel that acts on violations of federal law that ban disability bias and other types of discrimination in the workplace. Now, without a quorum, the commission can't approve certain cases or issue new guidance. The hobbling of the commission comes amid an increase in disability claims filed with the EEOC. The 88,531 new such cases in fiscal 2024 reflected a 9% jump from fiscal 2023. Efforts to downsize the federal government are also having a disproportionate impact. The federal government has long enjoyed a strong reputation for hiring and accommodating people with disabilities, and nearly 1 in 10 federal workers have disabilities, compared with about 7% of workers in the U.S. overall. In addition, people with disabilities can be appointed to federal jobs under a program that streamlines their hiring. It comes with a probationary status of up to 2 years, compared with 1 year for most other federal employees. In cutting staff, the administration has targeted federal employees on probation, which disproportionately hurts people with disabilities because they're more likely to have longer probationary periods. Some advocacy groups are calling on the administration to restore services for people with disabilities. The National Association for the Deaf, for example, called for a return of the White House press conference interpreters. Hundreds of people took to social media outlets such as Facebook to post about the lack of interpreters, commenting, for example, that we don't matter and never will, and I hope accessibility returns. That's all the time we have for this session of the Disability News Program. This is John Curry, your volunteer reader. I thank you for joining us, and thanks for listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.